Tonight we continue our series on my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness. We are now on chapter 6. This chapter is entitled Science and Spirituality. So I'm going to read two quotes here. The first one is by Joseph Campbell. "The image of the cosmos was changed with the development of the mind and knowledge. Otherwise, the mythic statement is lost, and man becomes disassociated from the very basis of his own religious experience. Doubt comes in, and so forth. You must remember all the great traditions and little traditions in their own time were scientifically correct. That is to say, they were correct in terms of the scientific image of that age. So there must be a scientifically validated image. Now you know what has happened. Our scientific field has separated itself from the religious field, or vice versa. This is a fatal thing, and a very unfortunate thing, and a totally unnecessary thing." Joseph Campbell. And then by Arthur C. Clarke. "Politics and religion are obsolete. The time has come for science and spirituality." So as we continue the exploration of the three principles of oneness, tonight's talk in this particular chapter is about looking at the way within which science, or how things work, and spirituality, why things matter, have been, as Joseph Campbell said, divorced. Now the reason for this is manifold, and it would probably take too long to go into for tonight's talk. But suffice it to say that as we learn more about how the universe actually works, at least based on the understanding and the technology that we have today, there was a growing conflict between the mythology of a lot of the religious traditions that were very important to the West, and for that, to that point, the modern world. And as new discoveries in science began to challenge these ideas, you saw this growing and growing separation. Some people say that it goes back as far as the Copernican Revolution, or maybe they talk about big moments like Darwin's theory of evolution. And what you found is that we as a society or culture are experiencing something that no other culture has ever experienced before. Every culture heretofore had a cosmology, had a science that was completely in harmony with how things worked, with why things matter. And this harmony is what allowed societies to flourish and grow. When this is removed, when the affect imagery of the religious traditions are being challenged and even overthrown, the human being has not changed. The human being still has a yearning to belong. It has a yearning to be connected to something larger than itself. And you might go so far as to say there are certain universal archetypes that will still continue to speak. Unfortunately, what happens is that as that affect imagery is lost, the people go through a period where they have no clear vision. And that gap often is filled with secular versions, religions that no longer are centered in ideas like love or grace, but they become vehicles of control, of power, of judgment. And so one of my passions and one of my personal beliefs is that we must bring those two worlds together again. We must bring them together again so that wisdom and not knowledge is what's at the heart of our culture, our values, and how we create character. Without this, we will be lost. It's that critical. Now, in the book, I mentioned in this chapter how, you know, folks have tried to reconcile. And one of the ways is by creating separate magisteriums. Stephen Jay Gould, the famous evolutionary theorist, you know, said, why don't we keep religion over here, and they'll just talk about why things matter, and science and technology and knowledge will just be about how things work. And while I think that his efforts were kind and even had a sense of good intention, ultimately, it still keeps them separated from each other. There's no real connection. And what you find is you find different religious traditions trying to catch up to the knowledge. But the problem is, this never quite works. Because so much of why things matter rested upon an earlier science and earlier knowledge, which we no longer accept. And what the mind cannot accept, the heart cannot embrace. And so again, I say, we must bring these together. So when I talk about scientific concepts, or I'm going to teach the Dharma, or I'm going to help someone pastorally who's going through a difficult time, or maybe is going through grief, I can refer to scientific ideas and knowledge as a way of communicating a message of hope and liberation. And I can do this seamlessly. And this is the type of education that clergy need to have. And of course, in our seminary, in the Blue Lotus School of Mindfulness Arts, our seminarians are trained this way. And that doesn't mean they have to be experts in science, but it means that they know how to have conversation. They know how to speak with authority and speak with a seamless harmony between what were known as two worlds. And this effort comes out of our essential understanding that everything is one. And so therefore, there is no duality. There is no separation between these two. It's artificial. And perhaps it's just a process of growing pains. But now, more than ever, we need this. We really do. Now, one of the things that I've been saying throughout these talks is, you know, talking about the place of evolution. So evolution for me is not something separate from spirituality. In fact, I would say that evolution is all about consciousness. That for me, evolution is the way within which life forms become more and more complex consciousness becomes larger, more boundless, and universal. And when we have a view like this of evolution and consciousness as really being one, then we can begin to bring other understandings, other insights into the language of spirituality, so that ultimately, whether I'm using a scientific term or I'm using something that would be considered traditionally a spiritual term, either way, what we're experiencing is oneness. And so on this end, as I said, our clergy need to deepen their understanding of science so that they can communicate the language of oneness. Likewise, science must aid spirituality. It must be a tool for us to deepen our sense of spirit and what spirituality actually is. And ultimately, I believe that technology can create a convergence, a way for us to understand the spiritual that no longer is defined by old world views or old mythologies. So, for example, when someone is going through grief, if I want to talk about the idea of what happens to us when we die, I can use both languages. I can use the explorations in consciousness and the understandings that have grown to give a clear and confident sense and help that person to have a sense of meaningfulness that does not depend on an old worldview or an old mythology that's millennia old, that may not make sense anymore for a modern person. And I don't really want to go into this tonight, but there is, in my mind, the oneness of these two enterprises will bring about a co-creation and guide that will lead us to what I would say is the ultimate point of evolution. And I call that nirvana. That's the language the Buddhists would use. Or we might say the ultimate cosmic Buddha realization. And I think that that realization will probably include things that we might even call transhumanism, where our science and technology and our human spirit are also no longer separate. And this intercommunion is what I believe the whole point of the thing is. So right now, we're living a bit in between cosmologies. And the primary way that this is played out is by those who are focused on the phenomenal world of matter, and that is an idea which makes sense on a very ordinary level, and the studies and revelations of consciousness that we have through science. And that's the main place within which I think that conversation hinges. Because those that are focused on matter and believe that matter ultimately is composed of some smallest thing, and you get to the smallest thing, and that explains everything else, or that matter is the beginning and end all, then you move to a place where the phenomena of consciousness, which without science is even possible, you find that folks in that camp begin to think of consciousness as something that's just an epiphenomena of matter, or more, even worse, that consciousness doesn't even really exist, that it's some sort of phantasm, and that humans are reduced, as I've said many times, to meat zombies made of bone and muscle and blood, signifying nothing. But the problem with this is that when you look at science in terms of the study of consciousness, and you look at it just in understanding that idea, that attitude that, you know, everything has got some basic small thing you can refer to. When we got into quantum physics, it destroyed that idea. And this is very much related to a Buddhist teaching. In the Buddha's day, there was also a belief in the smallest thing that somehow really existed, and it was separate from everything else. And in Sanskrit, it was called Atma. The Greeks took that idea and they called it atom, A-T-O-M. And that was the belief for the longest time, that the atom was the smallest thing, and somehow it was independent of everything else. But the quantum world destroyed that idea. We now know that beneath the atomic structure are all new worlds. All new worlds that have been opened up by our technology. So that's why it's so important that these things come together. So I would put forth to you that the idea of matter, the idea of there being something small that we'll get down to, and that will be the thing that is separate, is the same delusion that the Buddha was addressing 3,000 years ago. There is no such thing as the basic smallest thing. It doesn't exist. Nothing exists that way. Nothing exists separate from everything else. And one of the things we learn about the basic forms of the universe, which are called fractals, as these fractals also have a recursive aspect to them that goes out into infinity. And even more interesting, in some ways to me, a symbol of that great cosmic nirvana point, is the figure known as the Buddha draught, which is a computerized amplification of the fractal nature of existence, which looks eerily and incredibly like the position of a seated Buddha. And if you haven't ever seen it before, just look up Buddha draught. So these basic forms of the universe themselves seem to create an affect image that is remarkably similar to the ones we use. So we have to help our science move away from the matter myth and focus more on consciousness. And consciousness is the missing element and the aspect that brings it all together. And we have to expand what the empirical or evidentiary model is, so it includes consciousness. And of course, there are a ton of people doing this already. From Wolfgang Pauli to Sir Roger Penrose. And so it's already there for us. And we don't know everything, of course, but we're beginning to understand more and more the relationship between consciousness and the cosmos, and even with our own bodies, in the field of neurotheology, the way within which we serve as transmitters and revealers of consciousness, so that our story carries us from the basic primordial sense of consciousness into primitive consciousness, into self-awareness, and then that which is enshrined in the image of the awakened Buddha beneath the morning star, universal consciousness. Because spirituality is the way in which consciousness and society finds its center. And so ultimately, bringing those two worlds together is a way for us to find our center. Because without that center, an individual cannot grow, a society cannot grow. And so I would encourage you, in whatever manner and way that you find, to share this concept and idea. The last thing I want to say is give you an example of the difference. In World War II, the Nazis, the National Socialist Party, created an empire. And that empire was led by a man named Adolf Hitler. And science, they were good scientists. But the problem is their science was removed from wisdom and compassion. And so it was purely about knowledge and power. And we saw this in things like eugenics. We saw the horrible way within which science, if divorced from spirituality, can bring terrible things. And then another example was from the First World War. Terrible time for the planet. But there was a unique experience that happened in 1914 that involved over 100,000 soldiers on both the German and the Allied side. It's called the Christmas Truce. It was Christmas Day, 1914. And it wasn't created by those in authority. The soldiers themselves began to show the way within spirituality transcends everything else, and it is the center. The Germans began to put up lights. They began to sing carols. The Allies responded. And they found themselves going into no man's land to share gifts with each other. Cigars, alcohol, sometimes food. And they allowed each other to take their dead from those bloody battles and take them back to their sides so they could be buried with dignity. And this beautiful thing, which some even said led to games like football, went on through the first of the year. Now, there were those that were opposed to this self-producing truce that was created by the spiritual observation of Christmas. One of those was a corporal in the German army. He was deeply offended by this truce and sought to end it, which eventually they did. And little word of this got out. There were little snippets of it, but the censoring and the politicizing of journalism kept it really from being revealed too long after. That corporal was Adolf Hitler. And it was the people in power who were against this sort of spontaneous truce. And I think that tells us something. So these examples show us that science in itself, knowledge in itself, will never, ever be able to save us, will never be able to liberate us. And it is only science in the service of spirituality that will accomplish this.